You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are on Etna.
Cozze citere, cozze, cozze vicine, nus picudeci cora, nus picudeci cora. Cozze citere, cozze, cozze vicine, nus picudeci cora, se lu mangiano le femmine.
Stage 6 of our Giro d'Italia, and well, the usual question, Lionel, where are we?
We're still on Sicily. Mount Etna looms above us, and Daniel, I'm already looking forward to a virtual version of our journey across from Sicily to the mainland. A virtual 3-hour queue to get on the ferry awaits us after this, I think.
Well, maybe we'll hear some classic highlights from, you know, the very fond memories we have. It feels like we've done that journey about half a dozen times, but I think it's only twice, is it, Napalm?
It is.
But yeah, it's something that tends to lodge itself like a very painful pebble in the memory.
It's chilly up here, isn't it, chaps? You really feel the altitude, because of course down at sea level it's hot and sultry, but up here there's a cool breeze blowing, and I'm a bit, I don't know if I've got enough clothes on for this.
It's a live volcano, Richard. Far better it be chilly up here than scalding hot, I can tell you. That would be a bad sign on Etna.
True, that
don't
is
want it
very good point.
While we're up here.
That's a good point. What have we got coming up in today's episode? Well, we're going to be looking back at the 2002 Giro d'Italia and Cadel Evans' debut in a Grand Tour. He was 25 years old. He'd been a mountain biker, a brilliant mountain biker. He was riding for the biggest team in the world, and he came quite close to winning the Giro d'Italia. But there was an almighty Etna-style explosion that he suffered. And we'll be speaking to him about that Giro and about what happened to him. And it's a fascinating interview. 2011 Tour de France winner, of course, Cadel Evans, been retired for a few years now. And he seemed to, I don't know, quite enjoy looking back, I think, at the 2002 Giro. For all that it didn't end up very well for him, it was a very important experience in a formative moment in his career. But before we get to Cadel Evans, Lionel, can you give us a tale of the tapa, please?
I can. We are on Mount Etna for the first proper summit finish of the Giro d'Italia, and is it a volcano a mountain, Daniel?
Yes,
I guess it is, yeah. Well, anyway, yeah. The Giro has been here five times before. In 1967, Franco Bitossi won. In 1989, Acacio da Silva won. In 2011, Alberto Contador won, but later had that victory scratched out of his office palmares because he tested positive for clenbuterol during the Tour de France, and he had a whole couple of years' worth of results were wiped out. 2017 was the first time I went there. Well, we were all there, weren't we, to see Jan Polans win up there on Etna, a stage that was kind of, it was neutralised somewhat by the headwind, wasn't it? The following year, Mitchelton Scott's Esteban Chavez and Simon Yates did the 1-2, and Chavez took the stage, and that was really what set Yates up for his near 3-week long domination of the pink jersey. But we all know how that ended. So, well, let's go and see how the Elephant of Watford is getting on the brutal slopes of Etna on the virtual platform RGT.
Should you say, Napalm, you'll be climbing up Etna from on a road that the Giro hasn't used before, or it hasn't gone all the way up to 1,775 metres on this road before. So, yeah, new ground for the Giro, new ground for the Elephant of Watford.
Well, I'm on the lower slopes of the climb now, the first summit finish of our Giro at the top of Etna. As Daniel said, a different road up. I'm quite a long way on the road behind the Buffalo. Let's hear how he's getting on up ahead of me.
Well, there were rumours of a protest at the foot of Etna by the peloton today, but it didn't happen. Typically, self-interest took over and everyone's scampering up the climb. It's an absolute brute. And, feelings haven't softened towards race director Daniele Fribarancini. There was famously a director of the Tour de France who only lasted one tour. Daniel Frib, our colleague, has written about him. And Daniel's alter ego, Fibrincini may be headed in the same direction. He may be getting his jotters after this one because, well, Mount Etna today, an absolute brute. But the end is in sight. Onward.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker, flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
My name's Karen G, and I am the Go Ride coordinator for the junior part of Kendall Cycle Club. So we've got a group called Bike Buddies, which is for the very young children, and they can start as soon as they're able to either ride a balance bike or a pedal bike. And then when they get to an age where they've started school and they've been at school for a couple of terms, they can move up into the more formal coaching, the Go Ride. And then we take them all the way through into their teenage years, really.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWalker, who, as you heard in the clip there, also support the Kendall Cycle Club. They are very into their cycling, iWalker, and we are very grateful to them for their support, enabling us to be here at our Giro.
I remember.
They show every wheel to a race live on TV, so the Giro is live every day, so the following's getting bigger and bigger.
My name is Songezo Jim. I ride for Team Dimension Data for Kubeka. Yeah, my Italian is not so good, actually. Yeah, I speak a little bit Italian, but not so much. Just enough to get by, you know, but not a lot. When you get to the restaurant, scusa, possibile tavolo per due if you're two guys or whatever, you know, just to order food and to get by, that I can manage, yeah.
My name is Marhawi Kudus. I'm riding with Dimension Data. At home, they are really getting crazy. Also, yesterday it was Independence Day in Eritrea. So they watch both. Already I got some messages from my home.
Hello, I'm Ching. I come from team Giant Opposing. The Chinese face is not usually for the cycling world in Europe, but we're coming. So we're coming not only once.
My name is Hugo Hull, and I'm racing for AG2R La Mondiale. In the past, the Giro d'Italia was not on TV in Quebec since 2 or 3 years, RDS. It's following me here around every day. So in the past, people were playing golf, you know, and now it's more, it goes into cycling, the big business. So now cycling is doing really good in Quebec.
Genki Yamamoto, Nippo Binyuhantini. Japanese people want to see Giro d'Italia.
You are listening to Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast, supported by Science in Sport.
Well, Amicord, today our sort of reach into the Cycling Podcast vault from previous Giri that we have covered. That was an opening to an episode of Kilometre Zero from 2 or 3 years ago. Giro Mondo, it was called, and we spoke to riders from all around the world who were taking part in the Giro, so it was giving a real international flavour to the race. And the Giro that we're looking back at in this in today's episode was one that came close to being won by an Australian rider. No Australian has ever won the Giro, so that would have been historic. I mean, there were lots of other reasons for it being very notable. Cadel Evans is the rider in question. It was his first year as a professional on the road with MAPI, the world's biggest team. He had obviously been a brilliant, one of the world's best mountain bike riders. MAPI weren't actually his first road team. He rode part of the previous season for Cycle. He'd ridden for Cannondale as a mountain biker, and there was a link there. But his first full season as a professional on the road was with MAPI, at the time the world's biggest team. And he went to that Giro d'Italia in 2002, really to ride in support of Stefano Garzelli as team leader. That we talked about the 2002 Giro a couple of days ago in our episode about some of the big controversies and scandals at the Giro. It was, well, Daniel rattled through all the scandals at that Giro. It was quite extraordinary. And in that context, maybe Cadel Evans' spell in the Malia Rosa and his eventual collapse didn't get maybe the attention it deserved, but it was one of the extraordinary stories in what was an extraordinary Giro, wasn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, it was, Rich. And just going back to his move from Saeco to Mapei, so as we mentioned before, I think, I was working for Mapei in 2001, and I actually saw his contract.
Did you have the final say over
data
it?
Data security wasn't great in the Mapei offices in Viale Jenner in Milan. And, well, I remember this because, you know, obviously I was already covering cycling at the time, and but working for Mapei at that time. And then one day, and I don't remember whether Evans was there himself, but I was in the marketing department, and on the way up to sort of Dr. Squincy, the team owner's office, you had to kind of pass our floor. And I can't remember whether Evans was there, but Tony Rominger, his manager, was definitely there. And and I sort of got wind. The murmur went around that Cadel Evans was signing for Mapei that day. And for some reason, his contract kind of was being processed or was on someone's screen in our office. And I remember walking past it and seeing his whole bonus scheme. Scandalous, really.
On quite generous bonuses, are you allowed to say,
remember,
or is that confidential?
I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't say.
Bonus-heavy contract? Can you tell us that much? I mean, how, would the winning the Giro have been life-changing for him?
I can remember how much the World Championship was, and I think Major Tours and the World Championship were the same scale of bonus. Comfortably in six figures, shall we say. Comfortably.
Well, I mean, he did come pretty close to winning the Giro in strange and extraordinary circumstances, as I've said. And he only spent a year with Mapei, but in speaking to him about that Giro and about that year, what was really clear to me was the sort of legacy of that experience and the deep impression it left on him and really kind of informed a lot of the rest of his career, I think, and made him, it seems to me, determined to find another home equal to Mapei in the sense that, you know, it was a real sort of family team that had very strong leadership, I think, through Dr. Squincy. So, listen, we're going to hear from Cadel Evans. Lionel, sorry, you got something to say?
Well, I was just going to give an extra bit of context to what happened in the run-up to the day that Cadel Evans rode in the pink jersey, because, well, we talked about all the riders that got kicked out of the race. It was a strange Giro as a result of that, wasn't it? And the German rider Jens Heppner, originally an East German rider, of course, was in the pink jersey, and he'd finished 10th in the Tour de France 10 years earlier. Heppner was 37 years old at the time, and really not somebody that you would have thought would win the Giro, but there was only this, you know, last couple of mountain stages and then a time trial to go. And so when Evans got the pink jersey at the end of stage 16 and held a lead of 16 seconds over Dario Frigo and 18 seconds over Tyler Hamilton, it was all very close. Paolo Savoldelli, the eventual winner, was in sixth place, only 48 seconds down. But you couldn't say that Evans had won the Giro by any stretch, but he was in a fantastic position going into stage 17. An absolute brute of a day, 222 kilometres. And, as I think he says at the start of the interview, they'd done 6.5 hours of riding before getting to the final big climb. But if he just made it, he probably would have won the Giro. That's how close it came.
Well, we'll hear from Cadel Evans speaking from his home in Switzerland. He'd been out riding his bike that morning. And we'll hear also from Dario Cioni, his Mapei teammate, who helped nurse him up the slopes in the end. Take me back, really, to being part of that Mapei team. It's such a kind of institution in Italian and world cycling. What was it like for you to come into that?
So I just come across, it was my first year full-time on the road. So coming into Mapei and everything, I'd been doing in between the mountain bike races with Saeco because of the shared bike sponsorship. I could do that, and Mapei had seen me and said, would you like to come with us and develop as a 3-week rider? It was a moment in my career and life where I just really needed a new challenge and new surrounds, and then all of a sudden you have the biggest and best team in the world that wants to work with you, to which in my mind was the rest of my dream as a pro cyclist. But it was also, you know, to be a top mountain biker is one thing, but to be able to go and cross and I'll go and do grand tours as a GC rider. If I'd said it to anyone at the time, they would have thought I was an idiot. So it was all a bit. It was euphoric, I suppose, when I look back at it now. And that's euphoria and the whole everything happening and everything moving so quickly and going so well was, a wave of a euphoria that got me into the position going to the Giro. To answer your question, though, the MAPE team and the whole, not so long ago, I reflect on an obituary I wrote for Dr. Squinzi. One thing that amazed me with MAPE, and this goes not just in the cycling team, but the organization, the company and things. My first team presentation, 2002, arrived. We all got our MAPE suits everyone within the team and all the riders, Dr. Squinzi MAPE, everyone was so proud and respectful of him. And then we go to the team presentation, which is about, I don't know, hundreds of MAPE staff from the company. They come here and he puts on a big lunch in a stadium, and I saw within everyone just this amount of respect for Dr. Squinzi and MAPE, the company. And it actually shaped my mindset going forward in my own life and my own approach to my own profession, that wow, through being respectful and being a good person, you can really build something. I always had this idea to be an entrepreneur and a millionaire, a billionaire, you had to be hard-nosed and take advantage of everyone you could. It was the opposite. Here's everyone who would give like their right arm to be in there and to be there. So it's not just that you had 150,000 employees around the world. I think you had about 150,000 people that were giving 110%. Whereas you were talking any company, if you've got 150,000 people and they're giving 50%, it's already good. But just because they had such deep respect for him, and that was within the whole company, but the cycling team was the same. And then, of course, we were well resourced, but most of all, we had so many good riders. If you look at the B team, Pozzato, Rogers, Cancellara, guys like that was the B team. We were Frere, Bettini, Garzelli, Andrea Tuffi, Daniele Nardello, and so we had this team. And then to go more specifically, just to finish the answer, the first race I did with MAPE was the opening criterium in Tour Down Under, and I was sort of fit and ready, but I just raced the national championships two days before or something, and so I was a bit tired, and it was a criterium and whatever, and there was a breakaway of three, and they managed to stay away, which was kind of unusual, but three Aussies in there. And anyway, afterwards, the sort of the debrief with the meeting is with Crespi, in fact, Alvaro Crespi, who's now the manager at Mitchelton. Is there three in the break, and no MAPE. It's like, well, there's three riders in the break and an opening criterion that means nothing in the scheme of things. And it's like, whoa. But every race we went to, we had a rider in every break. We had a presence. We went to one race, little race in, it wasn't far from where I am now, by Lago Maggiore. I think it was in, July, August in Italy. It was a small race. And we went there in the team meeting. Oh, it's not important. We'll see what happens. We won anyway. We won the race anyway. Beto was there. Yeah, get me to the front. We got in the group, bring back the break or whatever. He wins the sprint. But one race we went to that I went to with MAPE where we didn't go there to win it, which was, in summary.
So going into that 2002 Giro, I guess there's huge pressure on the MAPE team anyway to perform and ride well in the Giro. You went into that race. I mean, what were your expectations going in? You were there, going there in support of Garzelli, I guess, mainly.
Yeah, I was going there in support of Garzelli, but I'd been told from early in the season, January, in case something goes wrong, be ready. Okay, I'm going there. But also, I was a first year professional. I don't know if people remember or realize this, but okay, whenever you race in Map A, there was heaps of pressure anyway. I always put pressure on myself to perform as an athlete anyway, so a little bit more, a little bit less. And this was where, and going into the Giro, being ignorance is highly underrated. Sometimes you don't know what to be scared of. So when they're talking in Italian or something, this and that, I didn't understand everything, so it didn't bother me, which was sometimes it's good. Not when the meeting time, you have to be there to go to the airport, you don't understand that, that's a problem. But how nervous everyone is or how anxious everyone is when some of that gets lost in interpretation, that was to my side, as was going to my first Grand Tour. I really didn't know what to expect. So I didn't have high expectations, but I didn't have high expectations of myself, but I didn't have high expectations from others either. So I didn't have a lot of pressure. So that was an ideal scenario for myself. And I went in fit and ready, but a first year professional going to his first Grand Tour.
And how, you know, how did it start for you? I mean, it started up in Holland, didn't it, that Giro, before yep. a long yeah. transfer?
I rode the Tour of Romandy just previously, and it was freezing cold and snow, and I was struggling, and that was my race for me to perform and show myself. And I think I was third, which was okay, but being inexperienced to deal with the cold weather and so on, I really, really struggled. So the team was actually happy. Oh, you got third place, you gave everything. And considering the weather conditions, it was probably the coldest race. It was most people's coldest race of their career kind of race. But anyway, and I came for that and I was exhausted. And I remember we went to Holland and Brahma was there. Come on, we're going to go and see Zucchero. Zucchero's performing free concert. I'm like, oh, I'm going to bed. I'm too tired. And I think I slept from when I got there till the start of the prologue. I got up and I did the prologue. I'm not really well prepared for it or anything. I think maybe in the first 10 or something, the prologue. Oh, that was okay. No big deal. And then we started and started racing. And I was just there for Gazzelli. And the main, probably the big high point of the thing was I actually had Gazzelli on the wheel going into the last corner. And it was the same finish for Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And I let him out and he won the stage and took the pink jersey. But I think that was where all the problems came afterwards. And I remember the team were angry at me because I sat up a bit before to make a break in the group. And I think Hamilton lost 8 seconds, but I lost 8 seconds as well. What did you do that for? You lost time. And I'm like, hang on a second. I'm leaning out. He's the leader. You lost time. This was Sergio Passani, the second director. We've got the pink jersey. We're leading the Giro. Anyway, and so that was sort of my early memories of the Giro. And then bit by bit, we went through. And
you didn't go to the Zucchero concert then, did you?
No, I went to bed.
Skip that.
I went to bed and woke up about 3 days later. Oh, prologue. Oh, let's go. No.
But, I mean, Garzelli did start that Giro extremely well. He won that stage. He won it a few days later as well. Back in Italy. So it started extremely well for him and for the team. Do you remember, you know, your reaction when you heard about his positive test and what that might mean?
So I'm just trying to think back to the media and things. Because we were in the hotel, and I know we woke up in the morning, and all of a sudden everyone was this tail between their legs, and what's going on? I didn't know. I don't know why. For some reason, Robert Hunter was explaining everything and translating for me, so. So I don't know why Dario wasn't there because we were roommates and so normally. And then and I remember I'd met some Australians. There was an Australian couple there the evening before. Oh, I'll see you tomorrow. And they were there waiting in the bus to say hello. And we had strict instructions. Don't speak to anyone. Don't look at anyone. Get on the bus and go. So and then I saw these Australians and I'm like, I can't say anything. I can't do anything. And we got in the bus and we went. And it was pretty horrible. And then Gazzo wanted to go home. He didn't want to race, but he had the pink jersey. And I remember like being in the stage, like I had to force him to eat and I'm going back in because he only had extras. So I'd always this energy drink at the time. So I'd get him, come on, drink. Cause he didn't eat, he didn't drink. And like at dinner and cause you know, all this stress and everything going on. And that much I remember during the race. And then when he actually had to go home. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm a bit vague on that, but we are speaking about a race 18 years ago. So.
Mm. Yeah, it's quite a while ago. I mean, I guess more, it was a team Mapai that, you know, that again, coming from Dr. Squinzy, there seemed to be a strong sort of moral code on the team. I mean, did you, the you know, events around Garzelli and the fact he had to go home, did that shake the team at all? Did that cause
absolutely,
a lot of angst? Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And oh, it was Mapei, we were the Giro, we were leading, it was going so good, and then all for this to happen. And then, you know, at this point it's like, well, is the team going to end? people don't know. And in the end, because the team actually, that was the last year of the team, whether it was because of that exactly, I'm not sure. But yeah, everyone was tail between their legs, and of course, yeah, we've gone from sky high to
did it,
burrowing under the ground.
And what did it do to you? Did it knock you off your stride at all, or did you just kind of get your head down and think, right, you know, make the best of this? Or
not at all, because again, I was insulated, lost in translation. Ignorance is underrated. I didn't understand the full extent of everything going on, so I just kept on going with my race, and that's what I do. I was a professional athlete. My job is to perform as best as possible every time you put a number on, and so I just kept following those. And then, yeah, I was actually flying under the radar, and I'm moving up GC bit by bit, and I was just watching the telecom rider, whose name escapes me right now, who'd been in a breakaway and taken a heap of time, and he was going to crack.
Jens Heppner. Heppner,
that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I knew it was an H. But, he was going to crack one day, and I was good chance I could go into pink. So I was just sitting there biding my time, waiting for him to crack, because we still also had mountains and time trial and things to go on. And so I was actually in a great position, like in a selfish manner, where, okay, all this had happened, but all of a sudden it just opened this opportunity for me. Here I am. I'll just say it one more time, but I was a first-year professional on the Mapei team and about to ride into the pink jersey. And what in my mind was the right moment to go and win the Giro d'Italia. Didn't all come together quite like that, but anyway.
I mean, what were you learning about yourself? I mean, physically, I've read that you were, you know, you felt stronger in the third week than you did, you know, earlier in the race. I mean, what was that doing to you mentally? And for your morale, to feel that you were recovering well and that you were riding better as the race went on.
Yeah, well, this is where going back to I was a first year professional. I was doing my first Grand Tour, and ignorance isn't a blessing, lack of inexperience also. So the thing that I really learned afterwards, after the experience, was you have no idea how tired you are in the third week. Of a 3 week tour, especially if you're riding for GC. And the thing was, though, I was getting really tired, but I was riding into the pink jersey in the Giro, so I wasn't thinking about my legs. I was thinking about riding into pink and winning the tour. So I wasn't thinking about my legs, and but I was getting really tired. But also, you get a fatigue that's so fatiguing. It's not like a fatigue you've never felt before. I didn't know how fatigued I was, and this is the euphoria, whatever was bringing me through. And so then when we went back and looked at the heart rate files and things of the famous stage, Passacoe, which I really tried to delete out of my memory forever, like on the climb before, I blew up, but I kept going, euphoria, motivation, whatever. And so then when I'd already emptied my tank, but I kept going, but then when I emptied, it was like I couldn't walk. I could still ride a bike, not straight line, and that's the most famous, the biggest hunger flat in modern history of cycling, and
yeah,
it's all for everyone to enjoy on YouTube.
Crisi assoluta per Cadel Evans, il ritardo nei confronti di Taylor Hamilton è di 40 secondi, dunque 40 secondi di ritardo per Cadel Evans, che adesso è rimasto da solo. Se ne sono andati anche Engels, Neerman, Ivan Gotti e Rick Verbrugge.
Quindi Verbrugge adesso è davanti.
Sembra quite clearly. I did quite a bit of work that day, pulling all of the second to last climb. My name is Dario Cioni. I rode for Mapei back in 2002, and I'm still in cycling, working for Team Ineos as a sport director and coach.
Addirittura Popovic. Popovic sta andando
molto. I remember that I saw the car at one point. I was riding really easy just to keep energy for the next days, and I get the car, I see the car in the distance, and I said, oh, strange to see the team car up the road. It must have broken down or something like that, because I couldn't sort of understand why it was there. And then as I approached, I actually saw something pink in front of the car. I said, oh. And then I realized that it was Cadel in front of the car. And then you realize that, yeah, things must not have gone up for the plan for nothing. And it was actually a disaster. And so I got up to Cadel, and basically I was speaking to him, but it looked like he was deaf. He wasn't really reacting to what I was speaking. And I say, oh, come on, Cadel, let's go to the finish line. And still done a really good job anyway. And then I sort of went up with him to the finish line. I mean, I must have been 10 minutes down the... Once, when I did my job, I just let go and really went as easy as possible up the climb. And so to make up several minutes on him by going slow, he was... probably will be remembered as, for sure, his worst day in cycling, but probably one of the most spectacular bonks that we've seen for a long, long time.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet interrupting our Giro coverage to remind me to tell you that tonight's episode is sponsored by LACA. LACA is a community of cyclists working together to insure their bikes and equipment in the event of damage or loss, ensuring that the premiums are lower and the payouts in the event of a claim are swifter. But don't take our word for it. Let's hear from a satisfied LACA customer.
I'm Fiodora. I live in Dalston in London, and I started cycling competitively this year. So I did my first crit races in January. I got my road bike in September, and it's the most expensive thing I've ever owned. So I thought I should probably get it insured. At the beginning of March, when we were still able to do fun things, I went down to Preston Park to do a crit there, and I was definitely winning, you know. But on the last lap, someone caught my wheel, and I managed to skid into the fence and crash, and contacted LACA on the following Monday, explained what had happened. They arranged for someone to come and pick up the bike. They even went as far as to go to the original bike fitter who'd set me up. So not only did I get a new bike, but it was completely set up to my original fitting and specifications around gearing.
If this sounds like the kind of insurance you'd like for your bikes and equipment, go to laca.co.uk. New customers get £10 off their LACA insurance when they go to laca.co.uk and use the code PODCAST. That's the code PODCAST at laca.co.uk. LAKA.co.uk.
Vino del giorno. Chin chin.
The Cantina Marilena Reversa is the next wine in the Cycling Podcast Full Giro case. Now, this Nero d'Avola has been harvested from vines 45 kilometres south of Syracuse on Sicily. The grapes, after harvesting, are let to semi-dry in the sun, concentrating the flavours a little bit. Now, I remember tasting this wine 6 months ago, and remember the dark cherry flavours, the fresh crack of pepper, and a little bit of tobacco at the back end. Now, all of those flavours follow through onto the palate with a really superb tannic structure that had me salivating for a char-grilled steak on a wood-fired barbecue, some wild boar sausages, or even a game casserole. It really is a wine that cries out for some big flavours. We hope you enjoy.
Well, Daniel, I've got my bottle in front of me here. What's this one, please?
What's this one? It's another...
Well, I know, we've just heard what it is, obviously.
It's another... So, Rich, yesterday we had a Nero d'Avola. You're becoming a real expert on Nero d'Avola, I can tell. And, this one, I don't even know, it's a little bit more grippy than yesterday's. Sort of firmer tannins, I would say. Reversa means Well, I think it's Sicilian dialect. It means backwards or going against. And these boys, the Cantina Marinina, who produced this, they sort of pride themselves on going against the trends in modern winemaking. Again, another very sort of consciously made wine fermented in these huge ancient concrete vats. And lovely recycled paper label, natural cork in the wine. So, yeah.
Well, what do you make of the wine, Lionel?
Well, it's
come on,
hospital pass. It's very nice.
Mm.
Very nice. There a light lunchtime.
We should say we're too punchy for that. It is lunchtime, and we are just having a sip. We should say drink responsibly. Obviously, we do have a wine partner for the Giro, but we should. Say to our listeners to drink responsibly, don't overindulge on the wine. It's best in small quantities, isn't it, Daniel?
Yes, Rich. A dictum that you haven't always lived by, but anyway.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Extremely grateful to them. They've been with us since the Giro in 2016. And you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25.
Gruppo poco più avanti c'è Marcelino Garcia.
Comunque molto bene anche Tocing e lo stesso Dennis Lunghi che aveva avuto un momento di crisi. Vedo bene anche Manuel Garate e anche il corridore della Colombia Selle Italia Munoz. Subito dietro Munoz c'è Ivan Gotti. Comunque mi sembra che Andrea Noè stia per terminare il suo lavoro, sta dando veramente tutto. Attenzione che scatta Taylor Hamilton.
E mi sembra,
parte
mi sembra
Hamilton.
Mi sembra in difficoltà Evans.
Parte Hamilton. Hamilton, l'americano. Tutti si aspettavano che corresse in difesa, ma ai 9 km dal traguardo Tyler Hamilton piazza la stoccata. Vediamo se qualcuno riuscirà a rispondere, in particolare se Cadel Evans.
That moment though, where you took the pink jersey and the race, you know, there isn't an awful long way to go at that point.
Pasco was the last climb of the Giro.
Yeah.
We had the time trial, flat time trial, 40 km time trial into Milan afterwards. Yeah. So in my mind, I always had the team on the front to wear down Hamilton, Salvadelli, these guys, Frigo as well was looking, Frigo blue, Hamilton blue, I blew, and then Salvadelli was the last one to, I say blow, but he was already on his own by then, so he blew with 2K to go, I blew with 6 or something, but then I went so hard that Hamilton, Frigo, and these guys passed me again. I blew in the climb before, actually, but that's why I wasn't thinking of how fatigued I was, because I was a time trial away from Milan, and the last time trial I was in the fourth or something, and some of the riders had been eliminated who were in front of me already, so it wasn't like I had what I should have done was just ridden conservatively and let the race run its path, but experience.
In terms of the hunger flat, was it simply a fueling mistake or what, you know, what caused that?
No, it was, well, like I said, I was a first year professional. So until September the year before, six, seven, 8 months earlier, I dedicated the previous 10 years of my life to training for an event that lasted no longer than 2.5 hours. We hit the bottom of the climb, Paso Co, with 6 hours 50 in the leg, in our 6 hours 50 on the bike. It was a 14K climb or something. In the third day of mountains in the third week of a Giro d'Italia, and 6 months isn't enough to go from a 2 hour pure sugar burning aerobic machine to a 3 week tour endurance athlete, and it was lack of experience, but lack of just physical conditioning. Mm. But to get to that level, it's years of stage races and years of 3 week stage races, and then also the not understanding the fatigue was also the, because it's unlike any fatigue that I'd experienced before. But then, okay, next time, okay, I know I'm physically getting tired or I'm mentally getting tired. You know, in a 3 week tour, my head gets tired before my legs do, to be honest. Knowing those cues, I know how to control, or not control it, but deal with it.
And is it all? I mean, is it the case maybe that adrenaline had carried you quite a long way, and that, you know, that the moment that ran out, that the body just kind of collapsed?
Exactly. Yeah, I use the word euphoria as adrenaline combined with emotions combined with, but yeah, adrenaline, euphoria. Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember how you felt that evening? I mean, after struggling to the finish, what did you feel? Did you feel disappointment, or were you pragmatic about it, thinking I'm a first year pro, I'll have more chances?
No, I was pretty demoralized. I thought, wow, what a huge opportunity lost. I was pretty demoralized about the whole thing, actually, and I got over it shortly after. And okay, next year, I think after a while, it looked like I was going to ride the Vuelta, and we had the Commonwealth Games in Manchester, I think a week or two later, and so after that, yeah, sort of got on with my life and started looking ahead.
Do you think, I mean, had you won that Giro, you know, what would that have done to your career over the next few years? How do you think things might have been different?
I think that's an interesting question. I find that an interesting question because, of course, when I'd lost the Giro, I looked at it as a lost opportunity. But then years later, I look back at it and I think maybe, like, I look at the riders who come through really young, and you look at some riders who come through and they win a big race early and then you never hear from them again. Maybe it was a blessing in disguise. It was great that it could show the world what I was capable of. But had I had great success there, would I have been able to continue it? Maybe. But sometimes also success early when you're so young, I wasn't so young, I was 25, isn't always a good thing. So I look at it in the end, I'm happy with my career, but I speak about this 18 years later. For 2 or 3 or 4 years afterwards, of course, yeah, I still regretted it. But
and
there wasn't, going back, also, if I could just add what we spoke about and the fact that it was lack of physical conditioning, I looked at it as a huge opportunity loss, but it wasn't like I made a huge mistake or something. I gave everything I could. Had I raced a little bit more conservatively, maybe on that day things could have been different, but also it's time, water under the bridge now.
It was, I think, 8 years until you went back to the Giro again. Was that just because your main focus became the Tour de France? Was it because of the teams that you were on?
Yeah.
Or were you avoiding it?
No. I as a rider, people think, what's your favourite race? I love the Giro. I really love riding the Giro. And so it was because I couldn't go. And then, of course, I moved to the Lotto team, and their focus was the Tour. To do well at the Tour was everything. Outside of Flanders and Roubaix, to do well at the Tour was everything for them. So I was recruited to ride GC, or have a presence in the hilly races, but to have a presence in the GC side of the things in the Tour de France, because they had Robbie McEwen winning green jersey and so on. So that really became a focus of the team, which also a compliment to me. I was always to focus on the biggest race in the world. I'd also say from my home nation, from Australia, the Giro wasn't looked at as the big daddy of the cycling world. The Tour de France always was as well. So funnily enough, that things went with the Tour. And the 2010, the reason we actually went back to the Giro was, I wanted to ride it because I hadn't ridden it for years. But we were a pro-continental team, and we hadn't been selected for the Tour, but we were selected for the Giro. So, of course, we're going to go to the Giro. And so that was actually the main reason why I went back to the Giro in 2010.
So that was Cadel Evans and the story of the 2002 Giro d'Italia. I find it fascinating to hear him talk about not just the day that everybody remembers when he suffered a hunger knock, you know, like few of us have seen before. And I think there were a lot of conclusions drawn about the fact that he'd been a mountain biker and perhaps wasn't used to sort of 6-7 hour road stages. But what left the bigger impression on me in talking to him was how important that Giro was and that experience with Mapai was in the rest of his career as well. I also found him very relaxed and open in a way that he perhaps didn't always seem to be during his career, especially, you know, maybe in the years when he was trying to win the Tour de France. And of course, he went close several times before he did it in 2011. He was quite a difficult guy to approach back then and could snap, you know, sometimes at journalists famously. But found him in a far more kind of relaxed mode looking back at that 2002 Giro.
Yeah, Rich, he clearly does have very fond memories of the Mapei period, as do most of the riders who were there. But another question it's worth asking or worth posing is, would Mapei have continued, the team continued, had he gone on to win the Giro? I mean, purportedly they left the sport because of Garzelli's positive test in, you know, early in the race, which we mentioned. And, you know, had Evans won, who knows, that Dr. Squincy might have been persuaded to carry on. But, you know, I think much in the same way that we talked about with Kunigo the other day, Evans was almost in a sort of elevated into a bit of a false position, or created false expectations almost in spite of himself. I mean, it wasn't his fault that he ended up in the pink jersey that day, but he was really, he didn't have the experience on the road for people to realistically expect him to bring it home. And, you know, it took him a long time then to sort of learn everything he needed to learn to then finally, happily for him, sort of crystallize, bring that all together and win the Tour de France in 2011.
Yeah, it feels like that was the start of that project in a way, doesn't it? And when you watch the footage, it's a very kind of, he wasn't that young at the time, you know, he was 25, but he was quite scrawny. And when you look at, you know, Evans in 2008, 9, 10, 11, he'd become far, it seems, stockier, more robust, physically a slightly different specimen to the very kind of, you know, quite scrawny athlete that we saw in 2002.
Yeah, just lastly, he had a very good record at the Giro d'Italia as well, really. 14th in the end in 2002 after that collapse towards the end of the race. Didn't go back again until 2010 when he wore the pink jersey for a day, eventually finished 5th overall, but also won that really memorable stage, which we'll revisit, the one on the white roads when it rained all day and became a real modern epic, if I'm allowed to use that word. 3rd in 2013 and 8th in 2014 with another few days in the pink jersey. So a good relationship with the Giro. And when you look at his overall Grand Tour record, it was a long scramble to get to a position to win the Tour de France in 2011. And well, the whole journey started in 2002, didn't it?
Well, that's all for our Giro. That's stage 6 done and dusted. What are we back with tomorrow? What's on the agenda, on the menu for tomorrow?
Well, we're hitting the mainland, aren't we, chaps? We're going to take that infamous ferry from Messina. As I said, we might even...
I've actually got a helicopter booked, Daniel.
Of course you have. Of course you have.
Yeah, who knows? We might even hear some highlights or lowlights from one of those trips tomorrow. But we're going to the mainland. We're going to stay. We're going to hug the coast tomorrow. Ciro will be happy. We're going to head from Tropea, which is famous for its red onions. I've never been there, but I've always wanted to go because it's a beautiful little bay. And as I say, very famous in Italy for its red onions. And we're going to go from there to Praia Mare, hugging the coast. And it would be a sprinter stage, so we're going to talk about a sprinter. We're going to talk about Mario Cipollini, and it's going to be complicated, chaps. I hope you're ready for this. It's going to be two complicated days for us because we're going to have to pick our way around the sort of enigmas and contradictions of Mario Cipollini, the light and the shade of the Lion King, who, you know, if you've been watching Netflix recently, might also be compared to a certain Tiger King in certain respects.
I'm not sure he would welcome that comparison. But anyway, we'll get on to Mario Cipollini tomorrow. Before we go tonight. Some thank yous to friends of the podcast. And a reminder, if you sign up as a friend of the podcast at the moment, you will be able to watch our first film, And So We Rode. That's available for a month until June the 11th or June the 10th, I can't remember which, for friends of the podcast. So from me, a big thank you to Neil Goff, Paul Deacon, Luke Edwards, Clyde Wright, Andy Peterson, and Harvey Smith.
And thank you to Stan McDonald, Greg Sill, David Funk, Eric Johnson, Chris McNamara, and Brendan Kinsella.
And from me to Eric Hoff, Joshua Doyle, Roger Taylor, Simon Walton, Dan Hayes, and Grant Young.
And Richard Freeb again.
And Pavel Tonkov again.
Non spiego de cicora, se lo mangiano le femmine.